Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome to this very special interview where I'm going to be talking to someone who's got a far greater depth of historical knowledge than myself, and I love doing that. I absolutely love it. Today we're in the presence of the one and only Metatron. How are you, sir?
The Muppet. I'm very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Me? Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yeah, I'm all good. Thanks for asking. So, whilst I've got you, and without too much sycophancy, you know more than I do, and I love speaking to people that know about the ancient world particularly, and I know you're Sicilian of yes. extraction, and so I thought, what better thing to do than talk about Sicily? Now, there's so many things, from Pyrrhus of Epirus through to Patton in 1943. I thought to begin with, hopefully it's the first of many conversations, maybe we could just go through a whole bunch of things about Sicilian history, and we can just chat about it, and you can let me know some of your sort of real niche knowledge on it. Is that all right with you?
That's actually perfect. And what's interesting is that I think, but I mean, I'm a little biased, if you will, but I do think Sicilian history is absolutely fascinating. I mean, at the end of the day, so many powers developed in the Mediterranean basin, and Sicily is right there in the very middle. We are touched by three seas, you know, Mediterranean, Tyrrhenian, and Aegean. It's in the Ionic. So it's like a special place, and I love to start with prehistory, for instance. We can jump into the prehistory if you want. Like, usually people think of, unfortunately, when people think of Sicily, they think of mafia, which, I mean, is a reality, and we can talk about it if you want. It's a cultural reality, something that happens still. But I am more fascinated by the ancient period in Sicily. Mm. And, there is a lot of niche stuff that we can say.
I mean, there's so much to say. As an Englishman, you like to think, being condescending to an American or something, as an Englishman, you like to think, oh, we've got so much history. We're steeped in so much history. It's not a patch on Sicily, right? I mean, Sicily really, the layer upon layer upon layer upon layer. There's so many things you could say just to start to begin to outline it, like that it's both blessed and cursed by history, by its geography, where it is.
Right.
I would call it the jewel of the Mediterranean. Lots of empires throughout history have obviously thought of it that way. It's a crossroads of civilizations. I've heard someone describe it as an axis on which the Mediterranean has turned, still does turn, through the millennia. That it's been the heart of trade and conquest and empires, on and on and on. So, okay, let's start. Should we go through chronologically, sort of, basically? Let's start with prehistory then. So, go ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah, before we jump into the prehistory, which is one of my favorite things, there's some mystery. I'm going to tell you some stuff that's going to blow your mind. But not because of me, but because of some of the research. You know, I have a team, which is kind of funny, because usually my haters and Redditors deny the existence of my team, which is a way to... It's flattering, because they really think I do all the research. Like, literally. You're giving me all the credit. I've got a full team here. But anyway, some of the stuff we found, particularly about the ancient period, is mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing stuff. Very talented team, and I want to give them credit. But I do want to start, if it's okay, by debunking just a couple of myths. Okay. So, you know, I live in the United States, right? Because I immigrated here legally years ago, married my wife and all that. She's from here. You know what happened? When I entered the U.S., and I was going through customs, there's the immigration officer, and he asks me the passport. So I give him the passport. He asks me, where are you from? And I say,
was it on Ellis Island? He wasn't on Ellis Island, was it?
No. It's in New York. This was in New York. Anyways, I don't know. So he asks me, where are you from? I say, Italy, because that's his normal quick answer. He looks at the passport. It, of course, the passport says Palermo, which is where I'm from, my city in Sicily. So he looks at me and he says, oh, you're Sicilian, you're not Italian. Do you mind if I debunk a myth very quickly?
Please do. No. Go ahead. Yeah, get it off your chest, mate.
Here's how it works. Every Sicilian is an Italian, but not every Italian is a Sicilian. In other words, Sicily is a region. In fact, the It's interesting because it's the largest region in the entirety of Italy by land mass. We're talking at 10,000 square miles, I think it's in miles, and it's the fourth most populous. First foreign province in for the Romans, so there is a lot of history when it comes to this. But what's interesting is that, so yeah, no, Italian, Sicilian, they're not mutually exclusive. It's like saying, it would be like telling you, oh, you're from London, you're not English, like you can be both. You know what I mean? Maybe you can look at it a bit like what British, like the way you say British. Someone can be British, but you can be English, you can be Scots, you can be Welsh. I get it, it's confusing because it's an island. So of course you can't be an Irishman from England. Obviously not. But it's like Sicilians and Italians, not mutually exclusive. You can be both. So it's just what they ordered to clarify. And Italia, the word, is ancient. Because sometimes I get people in the comments getting mad at me, being like, you shouldn't say Italy when you're talking about the Roman period. But they did. There are literally thousands of entries of the word Italia in Latin. They used it. It's just that they didn't use it in the modern sense after Garibaldi, Giuseppe Garibaldi, the modern country of Italy. They mean it geographically, usually. But like already by Diocletian, the islands were considered Italy. So we're talking, we've been Italians from that point of view, at least geographically, since the 3rd century. Like, it's, I mean, the principate. Yeah. That was just very quickly to kind of underline the thing that kind of annoys me a little bit. Prehistory, yes. So I imagine you heard about the three populations, the Elimoi, Sicanoi, Siceloi.
Yeah.
Like the three populations, usually Sicily is divided in a map when you look at prehistory. Probably it's been inhabited since the Upper Paleolithic, Early Mesolithic. Have you ever heard, and I can see a lot about the populations because I love them, I freaking love the population, the Elimoi or Elimians, I think they're called in English, are my favorite, the ones on the west, because I am from the west. So I'll tell you a little bit about those. But I was going to say, oh yeah, have you ever heard of the cave system of Adaura?
No, no.
Okay. It's something you might want to Google. So in 1997, they found, so it's very recent, they found this cave system, which is literally like 20 minutes from where I live, where I used to live with my family in Sicily. It's like right next to where I live. And it was accidentally found. I think there was some kind of like allied ammunition explosion, whatever. I don't remember the exact details, but they found this cave, and the cave is prehistoric. And the cave has wall paintings and wall drawings and sketches. Now, usually it's been dated to 11,000 BC. So again, Mesolithic, possibly Upper Paleolithic inhabitation of that area, population. And it's fascinating stuff because usually graffiti or wall art of that type, like that ancient, it's usually animals. Maybe a little bit of hunting for hunter-gatherer societies, but generally speaking, it's animals. Not this one. The caves of Adaura show complex rituals. Ceremonial, maybe ceremonial burial, but just definitely ceremonial practices and dancing. 12,000 BC, 11,000 BC, these people are dancing, they're having ritual, they're having society, and they are writing it in the caves. So like, who were these people, right? That's the first thing you ask. I saw it. Now I think they closed the site because of lack of structural integrity. But when I was a child, it used to be one of the places where your school would take you, right, for school trips. So I remember it. And so the three people are fascinating. Feel free to interrupt me anytime because I talk a lot. My favorite are the ones in the west, the Elimoi. I get confused with the
Do English you consider yourself a direct descendant of those people?
Who? It's difficult to say. I mean, I would have to do the genealogy of the century. Plus, we don't exactly know who these people were. There are speculations either that these are originally from the Mediterranean area, maybe they crossed during a favorable climate shift from mainland Italy, but some people speculate they might be refugees from Troy. So the ones from the west, right. It is possible.
I heard the ones from the east might be from like the Iberian Peninsula, might be from modern day Spain, but
that's the ones in the middle. That's the ones in the middle, the Sicanians. Those are the ones in the middle, and they are the most ancient, as far as we know. The ones in the east, the Sicels in English. I get confused with the English term. The ones in the east are fascinating. It's going to blow your mind. They are most likely originally from Rome. Before the Romans were a thing. So
long
when
before,
we read the classics, long before. So here's the thing. The original Latins already as a people We imagine there is the idea that, again, Aeneas, right? So the Trojans, Troy is destroyed. The Trojans, Aeneas, go to relocate. They run away. This is the story. We don't know how much of it is myth, but they relocate. Where do they go? They go into the Seven Hills. And so they found Rome, but they find it inhabited. That's what the myth tells us. And generally speaking, myths are grounded in reality, so I wouldn't just brush it off as a myth. So the idea is Aeneas and the Trojans, they find some people already in Latium. And we can talk about the etymology of that word because it's mind-blowing. But anyways, they find some people. And then who are these people? They call them, the at least three authors that give us the same name, Ab Origines. That's what they call them, the initial people that were there. And if you think about it, it sounds a bit like aborigines, because it's exactly where that word comes from, which means at the origin. Mm-hmm. And there is another author that calls them Cascae, which means the ancient ones. And ideally, their king, the name was Latinus. So when Aeneas arrives with the Trojans and they find these people, they're like, let's unite. And in honor of your king, we'll call ourselves the Latin. Now, maybe the king didn't exist, but the idea that there were some people there before these Trojan refugees arrived and then they mix and become the Romans is possible. But then there are other historical sources that tell us even before the aborigines arrive, there were people there. So who were these people even before? We're talking prehistoric ancestry. And they tell us they are the same people that will then move away because the Trojans and the aborigines, they are there. They don't want to mess with the very ancient ones. And they settle in eastern Sicily and becomes the Sicels.
Hmm. Okay. So, I mean, the story about Aeneas and stuff, most famously, Virgil's Aeneid. And I reread that not too long, well, a couple of years ago. I had to do it years and years ago when I was young, but reread it not too long ago. And when Aeneas goes there, this is only obviously according to Virgil in like the first century BC in the age of Augustus. The king he finds there is Turnus, or that's the English translation in the book I had. The king that's already there is Turnus. Yeah. And maybe that comes from Latinus or something. I don't know. I'm no linguist. You're the linguist here. But
I personally don't think that the... So the king Latinus is probably a made-up thing, but the term Latium for the area, the region, right, the modern-day Lazio, the region where Rome is, we don't know exactly what that term means, but there is the possibility, one of the etymological translations, that it means the hidden place or the hiding place. Mm. So you'll be like, hiding from what? The Romans liked that idea, and they tell us, oh, it's because there was the god Saturnus, and he was running away from Jupiter, so the king of the gods. Okay. And he hides in this valley, and that's why we call it like that. Now, that's the mythological part. It's possible, however, that they called it the hidden place because the very original people lived in caves. So they were hiding because they were cave dwellers. That could be a possibility. It's not the only possible translation. Sometimes the other possibility is that Latium comes from latus with a long phonemic vowel, because latus with a short phonemic vowel in Latin means side, but latus means the expanse. So it's possible that it was a valley among the hills. Maybe that's where the name comes from. Or it comes from proto-Latin, latium, but trying to figure out what that means is...
To be honest, we're getting far ahead of ourselves talking about the Roman period. I'd like to start with... first thing, before we get on to the Greeks and the Phoenicians.
Yes.
Is there prehistoric megalithic structures on Sicily?
So you're talking about like Stonehenge type of stuff?
Yeah, just giant, like large scale sort of, stone...
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, the most ancient sites that I have lived, because I mean, from there, is usually the Greek coastal battlements of Selinus, which is Selinunte, modern Selinunte. It's in the southwest. That one is probably like, 3,000 years ago? But that's already the Bronze Age. So because, you know, the south was colonized by Dorian Greeks, so originally from northwest Greece and then Peloponnese. And then the east is colonized by Ionic Greeks, so from Attica, not far away from Athens.
We're talking about Magna Graecia here, so-called.
Yes.
There was a large migration from the Greek world, classical Greek world. The 8th century. I think famously they say Corinth was the first one, but of many. We're talking about the 8th century BC. Greek people, classical Greek people from the Aegean, moving and settling Sicily.
Yes. Yeah, they settled the south and the east. And then, but the northwest instead is either with these original Elymians, so which again we don't exactly know where they're from, but we know that they were building cities, and one city that they found is the city of Eryx. It's very ancient. It's modern day Erice, and it's my wife's favorite. I take her there every time we go to Sicily because it's an absolutely stunning town at the top of a mountain. Today it looks medieval. But I mean it. It looks like you're going back in time. Like, it looks like you're walking around the Elder Scrolls. I did, by the way, put on my full plate armor and walked around the streets of Eryx because it was amazing. I filmed it. I've got footage of it. But this is ancient. And then right next to it, the Elymians, they built a port town, which is modern-day Trapani, but the ancient name is a lot better, and it's Drepanon, which kind of, it means sickle because it looked like a sickle. And they built it as a maritime sort of conduit for that area. So the north was from these original people. Then the Phoenicians arrived and they built Mycete, right. Panormos. Then in the south you've got the Greeks. This is why Sicily is so polysemic, multi-ethnic, but also culturally, linguistically. You know, did you know that, for instance, Sicilian is not a dialect of Italian? It's a dialect of Latin. It's not a dialect of Italian.
Okay.
So sometimes people think, because I do speak it, I speak both. I was raised with both in my household, so I'm native of both. And they're very different. They can be mutually unintelligible at times. And in a way, Sicilian is a sister language to standard Italian, which is based on the Florentine Tuscan language. But it's not a daughter of Italian. And even Sicilian itself, I don't even call it a dialect. I call it a regional language because it has its own dialects. So Sicily is split into three, just like the ancient populations, even linguistically. And then you have sub-dialects that are like 9 or 10, depending on who you ask. And these are metaphonetically differently. I can go into what that means if you're interested or not. I don't have to go into the linguistic stuff. But basically, even between Sicilians or different areas, it might end up being mutually unintelligible because of all these different civilizations that brought in their vocabulary and language.
So one of the big things is this mixture of both Greek, classical Greek, and Phoenician peoples. Yeah. That's where a lot of documentaries or even books really begin with Sicily, is starting around the 8th, 7th century BC, is the Greeks and the Phoenicians, who, of course, most people should know, probably would know, that they are very, very different. And Carthage is, you know, the biggest, most famous, most important Phoenician settlement in the western side of the Mediterranean. So already, long before the Romans, before Pyrrhus of Epirus, before even, the Athenian expedition, you've got Phoenicians and Greeks, and they're fighting over, in various ways, they're fighting over the island.
Yeah, and fighting with the original people in there as well, at the same time trying to subdue them. The Phoenicians, of course, we know they're Semitic. They're a Semitic people. When it comes to the Carthaginians,
so from Tyre, to make sure, originally from Tyre, which is in modern-day Lebanon, isn't it?
Modern-day Lebanon, that's exactly, yeah. Right. And then it's interesting when the connection with modern-day Lebanon is severed, and then you only have Carthage on this side of the world, then Carthage is like, okay, then we are taking control of the Phoenician colonies, including Palermo in the north of Sicily, and then there is the whole situation with Rome trying to see who is going to control Sicily while there are still Greeks. But they are originally, they're Semitic, the Phoenicians, but actually I looked into this very recent new DNA analysis, and it seems like that the Carthaginians, by the time they're Carthaginians, the Semitic component in the DNA, it's only a core for the nobility. So the Carthaginians aren't Semitic anymore, only a small percentage of them. And their DNA, by the time of the Punic Wars with the Romans, has changed so much that now they are closely related to Aegeans, Greeks, and Anatolian people, and Sardini. They have the same DNA as them.
Interesting that it's not much sort of North African. It's still, it's still classical Mediterranean. That's very
100%.
Interesting.
100%.
So I suppose, because there's so much to say, we'll have to whip through it a bit. Let's talk a little bit about Alcibiades' expedition, the Sicilian expedition. If anyone's read Thucydides, and in that age, what we talk it is the 400s, isn't it? The 5th century BC or the 400s BC. Right, right. And the Athenians decide, crazy strategy, as far as I'm concerned. Or the leader of their polity at that point, Alcibiades, convinces them that they should go on a massive expedition to Sicily, which in the scheme of things isn't really that close to Athens. And they're in the middle of a very, very decades-long war with Sparta, and they decide they're going to go to Sicily and conquer Sicily. And ultimately, it's a disaster. As you, as a Sicilian, what do normal Sicilians in the 20th, 21st century think about Alcibiades and the Athenian expedition? Is it a joke to them? Is it deadly serious stuff?
Well, I think most Sicilians don't even think about it much. I mean, particularly the kids. When we review the history, though, here's the thing. I perfectly understand where they're coming from, because they wanted Syracuse. That's what they wanted. I mean, everyone wanted Syracuse. It was a powerhouse. It was extremely culturally significant. It was rivaling with the city-states in Greece. So had they been successful, because we know we've got hindsight, and hindsight is 2020, but had they been successful, the amount of wealth that they would have got, and which the Romans will get, I mean, Sicily will become the granary of Rome eventually, and there is a lot to say about wheat production in Sicily, and that's something that it's still significant today. So we can talk about that as well. But first, I think it was worth it. They rolled their dice and they lost also because the Spartans interfered with the fleet. So they did do that. But I got to say, it was worth the try because, if they had gained control over Syracuse and in general all of the grain production and the maritime trade, it would have definitely repaid for the entire war 10 times over. So I understand it. And even as a modern Sicilian, I mean, to me, Greeks are brothers. You know, we are the most Greek of all the regions in Italy. So, no hard feelings, I guess.
I mean, I'll definitely want to get into that a bit later, how Greek Sicily is in some ways. I mean, sort of in the Byzantine period, I've heard it described as a Greek island in a Latin sea. But we'll get on to all of that. We'll get on to all of that in a moment. Before we get, I want to ask you a little bit about Pyrrhus of Epirus. I'm a massive fan of the story of Pyrrhus of Epirus. And he famously had a big expedition, even fighting with elephants and things, wasn't he, on Sicily. And so what are your thoughts and feelings on Pyrrhus?
Well, I love that we get the expression a Pyrrhic victory, because the idea is he wins, well, except for the end when he gets murdered in the final battle of his life or whatever. But apart from the catastrophic ending, it is interesting that he's the one who created the expression, which means you win, but at extremely heavy losses. I mean, the guy sometimes was given impossible odds. And what do you like about I don't know, the expeditions in general or the wars?
Pyrrhus of Epirus seems to me, he's not quite as brilliant as Alexander the Great. But for me, it's close. It's someone up there. It's someone like, for me, it's one of the all-time greats of the ancient world. It's a shame, as you mentioned just there, his final sort of quite ignominious death, where an old lady threw a roof tile on his head and killed him. But other than that, he seems to have been an absolute badass, like deliberately getting involved in single combat and stuff, for real though, not lost in the mists of time, for real, if you believe the accounts. And even though the Pyrrhic victories and losing loads, he very, very seldom lost. He just seems to be a great general, a really affable person. Sorry, go ahead.
No, sorry, an exceptional strategist. I like the fact that you're bringing up the fact of how sometimes generals fought. And Alexander the Great is another example of that. He led the charges and sometimes get speared, and then he would literally be there. Could you imagine modern-day politicians leading a combat charge with a SWAT team or with, like, the commando? Because that's what we're talking about, right? Even medieval kings joined. Yeah. I mean, medieval kings would stay in the rear. I think classical antiquity is more heroic when it comes to that. Although, then again, it kind of depends. The Romans, they usually let the centurions deal with it, like the Romans do. But they are ready to fight. I mean, they've got their bodyguards, right? The praetorian, the praetors. They are like initially bodyguards of generals. But the generals are ready to fight. They're in armor. If something happens, the general is going to fight. It's like they know that that's going to happen.
Well, there's definitely some examples from medieval history. The first thing obviously always springs to my mind is King Henry V of England got involved in actual combat on the field of Agincourt. But there's quite a lot of examples. But in the ancient world, it's even more so. I mean, Alexander was supposed to have something like 30-odd wounds on his body by the time he died. Battle scars. Being over the wall first. Yeah, being the point of a cavalry charge more than once in a big battle. And Pyrrhus just seems to have been one of those guys. He would throw himself into the middle of a maelstrom. It's just great ancient stuff. It almost is like legend, although the literary accounts are to be believed, I think.
I think it's possible because these are a different, they are cut from a different cloth, ancient commanders like that. And in fact, Pyrrhus to me is even more impressive, and let me tell you why. Because in Alexander, and I love Alexander the Great, that's my son's middle name is Alexander, so I gave him that name. But here's the thing. There was a psychological aspect to it. Alexander believed truly to be a god. He believed to be divine. So I think that influenced his decision as well. Still brave and whatnot, but I think he actually really did believe that there was divinity in him. He wasn't just a mere mortal. With someone like Pyrrhus, I don't think he believed that, but he still did it.
So you know what I mean? He still did it. Yeah, right.
He still did it.
Okay, so we're talking there about like the late 300s BC. So it's not long after that. Let's get to the Punic War, the First Punic War. And that's really where the Romans and the Carthaginians first really start vying for full control as sort of the sole superpower of the Mediterranean, at least Western Mediterranean world. And it's fought over Sicily. It's a very long war, isn't it? It's like 20-odd years long. A very grinding sort of a war of attrition almost in Sicily. And the whole time, the thing that I find remarkable that a lot of people is often lost when we talk about the First Punic War is there's already Sicilians there. It's not just like a mostly empty island and the Carthaginians and the Romans are fighting over it. It's like there's loads of other factions in there as well. Lots. And it's just one giant mess, it seems to me. But I would love to know what a real Sicilian thinks about that, those that know about it anyway. I mean, is that taught in your schools? Is it something to be embarrassed about? Is it something you're very proud of? I don't know. You tell me.
No, it's just history. We love our history. It's... Of course, we go through the entirety of the thing. And besides, we read the Odyssey, and in the Odyssey, the Sicilian populations are mentioned. Homer does mention both the eastern ones, the Sicels, and he mentions the Sicanians. It's just that he treats them as one people, so it's possible that there was some assimilation by then through Magna Graecia and all that. But what's interesting is, so we're in 264 BC with the First Punic War. But here is something interesting. Have you ever heard of this idea that the Romans didn't have a navy before the First Punic War, but then because of the conflict with Carthage, that's when they make a navy. And that's wrong. It's a myth.
Okay.
So if you want, we can address it but it's an educated myth because it comes from Polybius. So it's not something that Polybius does say, the Romans didn't have a fleet, but then the Carthaginians, the situation with Sicily happened, so they build 100 quinqueremes and 20 triremes. He tells us the type of ships. The thing is, though, that he's been hyperbolic, and we know that. What he means is not that literally the Romans didn't have a fleet, because I can give you a date from when the Romans began their fleet, and it's a long time before that. And I can get that date from him. So I can use Polybius to debunk Polybius. It's hilarious. So what happened, and he's not the only ones. Diodorus Siculus, Dionysius of Halicarnassus speak about it. Titus Livius speak about the Roman fleet. So what happened is that in 509 BC, so we're almost 300 years before the war, the Carthaginians write a treaty with the Romans. Polybius tells us about it. And in this treaty, the Carthaginians tell the Romans, you shall not traverse with your fleet. They're mentioning a fleet, a Roman fleet. They say, you will not have your vessels cross this line. And they give us the name of a settlement, which is in modern-day Tunisia. I think, I don't remember the ancient name, the modern name. I think the French protectorate in the 1800s called it Cape La Farina, but I don't remember the ancient name. Anyways, it's in Tunisia. And they tell us, you shall not cross this line, because otherwise it's war. That's what the Carthaginian Republic tells the Romans. But then they add two caveats, and this is when it gets fascinating. Caveat number one, if it's a tempest or a storm and you end up crossing it, not a big deal, just leave. Second, if you are engaging in naval combat and you need to retreat from your enemies, you can cross it, but then you need to go back. So what naval combat? If the Romans said no, navy. Why are the Carthaginians even bothered? I mean, if it was just a bunch of fishermen, why would they even care? So they do consider them a possible threat, and they tell us, you're not going to cross this. And that's one thing. The second thing is that the Romans take a city called Antium, and it's a pirate city, and they take it. And then what do? They confiscate the vessels, and that's when Roman piracy begins. And you know who mentions Roman piracy? Alexander the Great. He says they're pestering him. He's annoyed by them. Because, of course, there was no Roman Empire, but there was already a republic when Alexander the Great was doing his thing. It's not like the Romans didn't.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
So the Romans did have a fleet. They had a navy. What changed is that in the First Punic War, they humped up. They went for a rearming, and they built a significant fleet that now could compete with the naval supremacy that the Carthaginian had up to that point.
Maybe you can remind me whether it's in Polybius or maybe it's in Livy. Yep. The story, I guess it's just low resolution or maybe even apocryphal, but that the Romans somehow got seized a Carthaginian ship, and they sort of and they what was the word? They back engineered it. They back engineered it, took it apart, and even found that the Carthaginians made so many ships that on each individual segment, it was almost like Lego or something. It was shown how to put it together and so the Romans were able to back engineer it and copy it effectively. And aren't we told that that's during the First Punic War, just before the First Punic War, something like that?
Yes.
And I can't remember I think it might be Livy that's in, but that, and they say that's the first time the Romans ever had a navy, but you're quite right. That can't be the case.
I can tell you the first time they ever built the first ship. It's in 620 BC when they founded Ostia. Well, now it's called Ostia. It's Ostia Tiberina, whatever. It's the first colony that Rome ever built on the coastline. That's when they started making the very first vessels, not as advanced as this, because this is completely different. But the Romans have been dealing with the Mediterranean. Well, why wouldn't they? They are a Mediterranean power.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I've been to Ostia once, and the beach had loads of cigarettes all over it, littered with cigarettes. But okay, so the First Punic War, the Romans win in the end. Basically, the idea is that all the Carthaginians were pushed off of Sicily, if they really were.
And had to pay a lot of silver. Yeah.
Yeah, but oh god, there's so much to say. So. I mean, well, Archimedes, quickly mention Archimedes.
Oh, yeah. Genius.
Surely every Sicilian child is brought up with the story of Archimedes?
100%. Yeah, 100%. We study him, the engines, the machines, the battlements, the defense mechanisms, all the inventions. It's insane. Could you imagine what you could build in terms of machines? Because these are machines. It's just that it's Bronze Age, Iron Age, and classical antiquity. It's their technology, right? So the stuff that they can build with ropes and metal. Although, if you want, at one point, maybe let's go through the Punic War, because there are a couple of things I want to tell you about the Second Punic War. But then we can talk about, there is one type of screw that it is attributed possibly to Archimedes, but in general it's called the Greek screw. It's a bronze type of construction that the Romans used for mining, and they possibly took it from the Egyptians. And it's a fascinating story because it's going to blow your mind how the Romans did mining operation under the soil, and they had to consider oxygen and water displacement. It's insane how advanced they were with this stuff. So we can go into it if you want, but Archimedes is, I mean, one at a time genius of the era, 100%.
I guess it's one of those, I imagine it's one of those people that's in your history that you're just very, very proud of, the way Englishmen might be proud of, I don't know, Isaac Newton or something, or, something like that. It's just one of your all-time greats. Because there's a lot of Roman mining in Cornwall, obviously in a later period, much later period. Yeah. But I actually studied Roman Britain a lot, and after a while, you read enough, read around Roman Britain, eventually they'll talk about the tin mines in Cornwall.
Right,
and remarkable. Yeah, not until really the 18th century was it surpassed. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, they had two ways to mine. They had horizontal mining operations and vertical mining operations. The vertical ones could go relatively deep, not as deep as modern mining, but then again, the heat conditions and the lack of oxygen would have off them, but they knew that. So what they do is that they use this this Greek or Egyptian screw, as they call it, and what they do is that they create a machine, a wooden machine, that can redirect underwater river flow so that it doesn't flood, and it can pump out the water. It tells us at what rate, and it can pump out the water. And then they use these like candles to see if there is oxygen. They keep going down, but then they have to check if there is oxygen. It's insane. Like the stuff that they could come up with.
It's remarkable to think that both the Greek world, or ancient Sicily even, or the Romans, came very close, perhaps you could argue, came very close to an industrial revolution, because the first steam engines, the first pistons ever, which is like the main component of an engine, was Britain in the 18th century, or late 17th, yeah, no, 18th century, in order to pump water out of mines.
Right, yeah, there you go.
Right, so if the Romans or the Greeks had made a couple of little, with the genius of Archimedes and the elbow grease of the Romans, they're right there, a couple of little things, and we might be 2,000 years further ahead in human development at this point, but it is what it is.
If you think about it, I mean, Roman cement, they figured out a way for it to self-heal underwater. So they compounded the chemicals in it in a way, the constituents in a way. This is, of course, through trial and error. That's how ancient people do it. But experiential knowledge is not to be underestimated when you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years of continuous trial and error. And so they figured out this way whereby when the cement goes underwater, it, whenever it cracks, the water enters and it sort of resurrects it and repairs it automatically. Can you imagine that? Like Roman cement, in fact, still stays strong today.
Yes. It's remarkable. In fact, I watched something a little while ago, probably about a year ago now, but it was a little documentary just talking about the cement used in the Colosseum specifically.
Yes.
And how remarkable, like the chemical, they analysed it in a modern scientific way, the chemical makeup of it, where they sort of couldn't believe how perfect it was, really.
And even Pompeii, just the other day I was hearing an interview with Christopher Nolan, and he was talking about ancient people, you know, they didn't have a modern scientific understanding, so to them everything was gods and the fire is God. And I'm like, you clown, you never opened a source, have you? Because here's the thing, when you actually read how the Romans reacted to the explosion of Vesuvius and how, you know, Pompeii, right? If you read, because you would imagine, probably the Romans thought the god Vulcanus is punishing us. Maybe some people thought that, I'm not denying it. But if you look at the historians, the emperors, no, the first thing the emperors say, we need to send aid. So they organize very well, put together aid to go and help the victims. Then they try to figure out the physical causes. Mm. Like they are very pragmatic. It's insane when you read it. And in fact, they even try to figure out why the soil, after the lava and the explosion, it becomes more fertile. And they don't say, well, the gods blessed us. No, they say probably it creates a layer of fat around the... Now, they were wrong, but they tried to explain it through physical reality and observation, which is very modern if you think about it. Mm-hmm. And have you ever thought the question, why did they even try to build a settlement near a volcano like Vesuvius? Like, wouldn't that be dangerous? I asked myself that question, and I found the answer together with the team, and it's actually mind-blowing. The reason is they didn't know, because the previous, now it's not documented, but now we know because of geometric analysis, the previous explosion or eruption of the volcano was prehistoric. So nobody knew. They didn't know it was a volcano. Now it looks obvious because you see it looks like this. It's because it exploded. If you look at drawings from the period before the explosion, it looks like it has a peak.
Top of it blew off. Was it Pliny the Elder? Is it Pliny the Elder that gave the account at the time? Yeah. And now it looks like a two double peaked thing with, but at the time it, they thought it was just a hill or at least
a
dormant volcano.
Because
there's Herculaneum, which is even closer, isn't it? I've been there, and Herculaneum is sort of right on the side of the mountain, basically. It's crazy how close that is. Because there's so much to get through. So I guess montage through the next few centuries, because this is the height of the Roman period, from after the First Punic War all the way up to the fall of Rome in the West. And now we're talking like the 5th century AD.
Right.
For that whole time, as you've said, Sicily exists as not just a part of the Roman Republic and Empire, but a key part of it, sort of their first overseas territory, and acts as something like a breadbasket for Rome. And so that whole period is when, would you say, this is the question, Sicily becomes less Greek and more Roman. Is that fair to say, or is that just silly, low resolution, and I've got it all wrong?
No, for sure. I mean, you can be a little bit of both, because at the end of the day, even in our language, we use terms that are clearly Greek related. So you can tell there is, and besides, do remember that even though the Romans conquered, the Greek temples are still there. So there is still a lot of Greek architecture there. And in fact, we've got, I think, we have the most well-preserved temples in the world when it comes to ancient Greece. They're in Sicily. So our temples are better. There was an earthquake in the Selinus area, but, you know, Segesta, there are still temples that are standing and you can go and experience them. It's like the Valley of Temples in Agrigento, for instance. That's the most famous ones, but there are other areas that are less famous and to me more beautiful, where you still see the paved cotto and the altars where the population, the Greeks, were doing sacrifices for the gods, like in terms of grapes and food and stuff like that. And yeah, they're still there. You can see them. You can still walk the battlements, 3,000 years old. They're still almost, not intact, but like that. There is one thing I wanted to tell you about the Second Punic War. So there is a lot to say, but Scipio Africanus, one of the things he did when he was dealing with Hannibal, which, by the way, Hannibal was in Italy for like 13 years. It's insane. How long? Like, we often, when we brush through it, we don't realize how long freaking Hannibal was in Italy and they couldn't get him out. But it's very famous how Scipio Africanus decides, I'm going to take the Iberian Peninsula. And then he does the counterattack in Carthage, Zama, and whatnot. But I would like to very quickly focus on what happened when he took the Iberian Peninsula, because this is something they always get wrong in every documentary, I swear, every documentary or video game. So the Iberian Peninsula belongs to Carthage until Roman troops go there and take it. When the Romans take it, one of the settlements that they take, which is a Celtiberian, they're Celtic people, is full of blacksmiths. These are the blacksmiths that invent the gladius. In fact, the first iteration is the gladius hispaniensis from Hispania, the Iberian Peninsula. So for any battle that you represent graphically that happens before the Romans in the Second Punic War take the Iberian Peninsula, the Romans should not have a gladius. The Carthaginians should have a gladius, because the Romans take the gladius when they take the Iberian Peninsula, and then it becomes the Roman sword. So a lot of situations, you see the Carthaginians with these like kind of falcata looking swords, and the Romans have the gladius. I'm like, no, it's the other way around. The Romans don't have the gladius at this time. They have three types of swords, in fact, one of which looks a bit like a falcata. The rest look like a mixture between Celtic designs because of Northern Italy and Greek designs. And it's the Carthaginians that have the gladius. The Romans just take it from them once they take the entire Oppida. With the blacksmiths, there were like at least I think 100 blacksmiths. The Romans confiscate them and say, okay, mass produce it, we want this. And in fact, before this, they weren't even using metal umbo, they were using wooden protection for the shield. And then they, because they take these, so like it's every time I see video games and I see, why are the Romans using a gladius before they take, like in the First Punic War? Absolutely not.
The First Punic Wars, Romans fighting against Brennus, or like any depiction of the early kings, all the Romans are using gladius. No, that would be wrong.
It's like too soon. That we know when it happened. We even know, I actually have the name of this settlement somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. Numantia, that's the name of the, that's where they engineered the gladius. And I'm not sure what the modern name, I mean, at the end of the day, the Romans always change names. Even Paris today is because the original name was Parisi, but the Romans called it Lutetia. So the Romans conquer it, change the name, because that's what they do. And then they start digging and they create the stone underground quarries that they used to then build the city, which is now the Labyrinth of Paris. It's part of it. It was expanded in the Middle Ages. The underground of Paris is insane. If you go in there, you'll never come out. some of which are ancient Roman mines, because they were literally mining downstairs, taking the stones, build the rest of the town. But then eventually they want to go back to it, you know, afterwards. They're like, no, we want to call it Paris, because the Romans didn't call it that. They called it Lutetia.
Wasn't the Parisi more like the tribe?
Yeah, but also the settlement. Both, yeah, they're both. Yeah. Often, yeah. Because you have ethnonyms, endonyms, and depending on how people call themselves and that kind of stuff.
Okay, yeah. So when the Roman Empire in the West finally falls, yes. Sicily isn't necessarily immediately conquered by anyone else, but we would get into the period of what, like the Vandals and the Ostrogoths, people like right. Theodoric and yeah. stuff. How do Sicilians, yes. how do you view that period? Is that something that is, well, because as an Englishman, when I think about and when I talk about time, particular times when Britain might have been invaded, sometimes the yes. feeling is, like the Romans, you're like, oh, well, good on you. You was a good opponent and you won fair and square. And other times it's like Viking invasions. You think, oh, they're mean. They're the baddies. Uh-huh. I'm not okay with that. I'm not cool with that. Do Sicilians feel like that about like the Vandals and the Ostrogoths? Are you indifferent about it?
Yeah, I think we're a little indifferent about it only because it wasn't long enough to define us as a culture. Whereas if you look at the Crown of Aragon in Spain, if you look mm-hmm. at the Norman conquest, those right. have left, or even the Saracens, those have left buildings, architecture, and the Byzantine that is visible today. So you have Islamic structures, you have Spanish or Baroque, for instance, as well. So all of that is in Sicily and it's visual. And the other thing is, for me, like I would say I kind of look stereotypical for an Italian, but like in my classrooms, and this is a little anecdotal, I get it, but just to give you an idea, in every classroom that I've ever been to as a child growing up, out of like 20, 22 students, three were blondes with blue eyes. So the Norman influence is there ethnically, you can see it. It's not weird to us. Some people have a darker complexion than me. Some people look exactly like me. And at the end of the day, it is because of the ethnic makeup of all of these different civilizations that stayed for a few hundred years, and then, you know, they were replaced by someone else because everybody wanted Sicily at the end of the day.
Okay, so to go through it a little bit chronologically, okay, so after the fall of the Roman Empire in the West, we've got Vandals, Ostrogoths, Theodoric, something like that, but then the campaigns of Justinian the First and Belisarius and the reconquest of Italy and Sicily, at least for a little bit, by the Eastern Roman Empire, the Byzantines.
Right. Byzantine, yeah.
So I guess that is, as you just said, basically, that is a much bigger part. And there's still lots and lots of there's lots and lots of Byzantine architecture still there to
Absolutely.
This day.
Yeah. Yeah, and the art, the Christian art particularly. In fact, when I went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, which contains a lot of European stuff, like a lot, I don't even know why we sold them everything. So anyways, there is a lot of like crucifixes and art that comes from that period, specifically that area. It's mind-blowing. To me, I think if you visit, for instance, Palermo, right? It's the Norman architecture that is the one that gets to me. There is the Palazzo dei Normanni, so Norman Palace, or like the cathedrals that were built as well during Middle Ages. Those are really the architecture that every Sicilian will know. The Byzantines, absolutely. But I think that's like for history buffs. But if you want to know what the general population recognizes, it's the Norman medieval period and the kind of architecture and structures and cathedrals. Those, any Sicilian, even if you ask a fishmonger, they will know about it.
Right. Okay. Well, one question I wanted to ask, I don't want to spend too much time on it or getting too deep or any sort of controversy, but the tension, if that's even the right word, between Orthodox Roman Catholicism and and Eastern Roman Eastern Orthodox and so in Sicily there's both, of course, but for you, in your mind, trying to explain for me a little bit what that's like. Are most people Christians, anyway, are most of them Catholic, or like most of them Eastern Orthodox, or what?
No, everyone is Roman Catholic.
Okay.
Literally everyone is Roman Catholic in Sicily. So the reality, besides, so that's it. I think we are too disconnected from that period to have any remnant of Eastern Orthodoxy. I've never met an Eastern Orthodox in my life.
Really?
Maybe they exist, I'm not saying, but I've never met one in my life.
Okay.
So everyone is... Romano, Cattolico, Apostolico, Romano, so Roman Catholic.
Right.
And yeah, that's pretty much it, honestly. I mean, it's really that simple.
Okay.
Although,
fair enough.
Yeah,
well,
yeah. So
just before we get to the Normans then, got to talk a little bit about the Abbasids, ultimately the Fatimids, the Islamic invasions. And that was before the Normans, right?
Right, right.
And so there's a period there. Is anyone getting the trend, the pattern, that lots and lots of different empires and peoples have... anyone realise it? So next up to bat is the Muslims from North Africa.
Yes.
Right? And so tell me a little bit about modern-day Sicilian people's thoughts and feelings about all of that. There's lots of mosques, aren't there?
Yeah, active mosques, I don't think there are that many. There are some repurposed buildings that occasionally used to be mosques. Like you can see it's called a cupola. I'm not sure what the term is in English, but basically like the spherical roof that you see on top of that. We see them in Palermo all over the place. Some have been turned into Christian churches, by the way, function Christian churches. So that has happened. I'm not sure. Yeah, there are very, again, I've only met one active Muslim,
really?
But then again, that's maybe why? That just has to do, I guess this just has to do with, and then again, now it's different with the immigration situation that it's happening in Europe. It's a different context, but I think, yeah, I mean, what they wanted to do was what they did in Spain. It's just that it didn't last that long.
Okay.
Pretty much.
Okay, well, so then on to the Normans then. So now we're talking the 11th century, right? It's actually about the time of the Norman invasion of Britain, the 1060s, right? It's the exact same time.
Yes, yes.
And so the Normans come in there, and I mean, it takes a few generations. It's not like one battle or anything, but... and so this is Western Europe now. This is the Frankish people coming in, and it's their turn. Next up to bat is them. And I just want to reiterate, there's still the ancient Sicilian people there, and all the other layers of conquest and migration and all that sort of thing, all one on top of the other still, like a palimpsest. Like, and so throw on top of that now, Normans. But they stayed there for a long time. And as you're telling me,
you can tell
a big imprint of it physically, architecturally, to this day is still there and still important.
Yes, and it's and linguistically, there are some words that kind of sound like, you could tell they have a connection to Norman French that we have in our language, the Sicilian language, but you don't find in standard Italian because of that. And personally, the Norman Palace and the cathedrals are what, to me, are some of the most impressive. In fact, the Cathedral of Palermo is phenomenal. And of course, with that one, then we'll have to go into the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies at one point. But you could tell how rich it was. Because now, you know, after the unification of Italy, the rich part of the country is the north. But the south used to be the rich part of the country. It's just that it got... The relocated a lot, the resources were relocated. For us, it wasn't a great deal, I'm going to be honest. Not that I'm a secessionist or I want to separate that. No, I'm more than happy to be Italian. But I'm saying, like, it used to be, like, if you look at the architecture, there's no way you're going to think, okay, this place is, like, opulent. It's insane. In fact, the Cathedral of Palermo is huge, but lots of statues. But the Cathedral of Monreale, which is a smaller town at the top of the mountain right next to Palermo, the inside is all gold leaf. Everything is gold inside the entirety of the structural. And it's fun because even the cathedral, sometimes the type of architecture borrows from Muslim or Islamic arches, but to build a Christian, it's a mixture. You can see Byzantine decorations as well. So when you look at one structure, sometimes it's mixed. So we learned this from those guys. We learned this from these other guys. Let's put it all together and build an incredible structure. And as I say, there's this huge imagine of Cristo Panto Creatore. So you have like the Christ as a creator. And then it's all gold.
it's all gold. It's like mind-blowing. Like the expense of something like that is insane. One could even argue, but I mean, Jesus was poor. So, I mean, one could argue that.
And yeah. Would have a yeah.
Yeah, but go tell a medieval king that. Go tell a medieval king that.
I was going to say, as a sort of an Anglican, Church of England, Northern European yes. Protestant, that's all in yes. terribly bad taste as far as we're concerned.
I get it.
A church must be a whitewashed, empty hall with no glass, with no stained glass. Certainly no gold. Oh, God damn. I'm okay, no gold,
but I'm keeping the stained glasses because those are incredible.
Of course, yeah. Now, one thing I would say at this point, I just want to reiterate something we said right at the beginning, that Sicily, its geographical position yes. means that it really has been a crossroads, a key to the Mediterranean. So by this point already, we've had people from as far away as the Holy Land, from Tyre, from Lebanon, yep. and from yep. Scandinavia. The Normans are yeah. really from Scandinavia. They're Norsemen, originally, first yes. and foremost. Yes. So you've got people from Scandinavia and from Lebanon, and they end up in Sicily one way or another. Just an absolutely yeah. remarkable fact, really. But so there's a couple of the key sort of Norman kings would be Roger the First and Roger the Second.
Roger the Second.
Are
well,
they
yeah.
known? Are they household names in Sicily?
Oh yeah. If you say Ruggero Secondo, that's how we say Roger the Second. Everyone, I would say everyone who has had an education. I mean, I guess it depends who you talk to, but in general, yes, these are well-known names. Because again, they are our history. And I guess even if you go into a minute school trip, because they take you to school, and I think that's great. Like middle school, you take the kids and then you show them all of these structures and architectures and buildings, which are still, the medieval ones are in fantastic condition. And I want to be honest with you, even the ancient sites are still in good conditions. I just wish that the Italian government, and specifically Sicilian authorities, they used it better. Because as you say, sometimes some areas are let down a little bit, or they don't have like the ingenuity that both English and Americans have, where you guys are great at using your own sites and your own things to, like, you know how to make money and business. We are great, we get a lot of tourism, but then sometimes they will block areas, you gotta pay. Like at one point, I even asked a formal permission to film. I want to tell you this. I asked a formal permission to film in this ancient Greek area in Sicily, and they rejected it. And I'm like, but why? And they said, well, you need to pay us $5,000 a day. And I told them, I can't do that. This is at the beginning of my channel. I'm like, you're joking. I'm not a Hollywood. But yeah. I said, and at the time, I was a full-time teacher. I was teaching in high school. So I said, but this is great because the students, we can make a mini documentary and the students are going to love it. Like our own people are going to know about the history. We're going to dress, we're going to be dressed up in historically accurate gear and we're going to do this. They still said no. So I did it anyways without their permission.
Brilliant. Classic. Yeah, screw them. Screw them.
Yeah, because the rule was you can't use a tripod. That was the rule. They said, you can't put the tripod down. I'm like, okay. So I removed the tripod and we filmed it freehand. It wasn't breaking the law that way.
Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Well, so going through, I mean, after the Normans, what you've got, like, the House of Hohenstaufen, right?
Right.
So now we're talking sort of more, or Germanic peoples. I mean, Frederick II, literally the Holy right. Roman Emperor.
Yeah.
So this is a German, these are now Germans. They're next yes. up to bat. Have a pop in yeah. Sicily, the Germans. I mean, is Frederick II sort of a known thing, or would you have to be like a real history nerd to ever know really
you
know?
You would
that?
Have to be a history. Yeah, you would have to be like either a young student who paid attention in class, or you would have to be like a history buff. It's okay. actually funny because the Holy Roman Empire wasn't holy, wasn't Roman, and definitely wasn't an empire. But hey, it's PR. It's like Subway here. White bread, they call it Italian, which is just white bread with better PR. That's what it is.
It's funny. I've heard someone argue that the Holy Roman Empire, because that's almost a cliche. It's not holy. It's not Roman. Yeah, it's not an empire.
It's a cliche.
People argue, no, it is holy. It definitely is Roman, and 100% it's an empire. What are you talking about? I've heard people argue both ways, yeah. But no, I'm of the opinion that, yeah, it's not holy, it's not Roman, it's not an empire. But okay, so
it's
then
pedantic.
We got like Charles of Anjou, right? The Angevins, the Angevin empire.
Angevins, yeah. Angevin
so,
kings,
I mean,
yeah.
They're French, essentially, or what today we call France anyway. So it's like, so the Germans just had a pop. Now the French. And then you mentioned Aragon, Peter III. Right, Spanish, yes. Effectively. Yep. So the yep. Germans, the French, the Spanish, it just keeps going on and on. It never stops, does it?
I want to tell you one thing that is interesting. You can tell the French and Spanish conquered that area. The Italian word to say work, or to work, let's say the verb, is lavorare. That's how we say to work, lavorare. The Sicilian word is travagliare. Interestingly enough, trabajar in Spanish and travailler in French, and we say travagliare. So clearly the Sicilians got influenced by those.
Right.
There is that. Like you could tell, even in like everyday, when this is everyday language, people speak it, it's still a language that is spoken in Sicily. We speak both, we just alternate.
Is there any particular bit out of all these various invasions and conquests that you guys aren't particularly happy with or particularly proud with? For example, I'll give you one example. In English yeah. history, there's one point during, I think it's during, I can't remember, I think it's during the age of King John, something like that. I think it's just after, where the French king, one of the Louis, yeah. came over to London, invaded England, came over to London, got into London, installed himself as King of England, but then within months, a few months, well, for political reasons, was deposed and sent back to France. And English history largely, really, really quite largely, tries to paper over that, and no one really ever talks about it, and you'd have to be a real history nerd to even ever heard of it. Uh-huh. And it's one of those things where it's like, well, we don't talk about that. We don't, that like barely happened. It's not a thing. is there any bit in Sicilian, out of all of these where, you know, Sicilians yeah. are like, we don't, like even the Islamic invasions, you're like, oh yeah, we okay,
today,
it happened, but we're not going to really
today,
dwell on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's large enough that you can't really consider it a footnote in history. But I think today, due to the current geopolitical situation, probably if you ask a lot of Sicilians, they're going to be mad about Muslims coming in the country. And then, of course, if you bring up the idea of but the Muslims already did invade, then you could be like, yeah, and they're invading again. So I guess, but that's a modern thing. So right. When I was a kid, it was just history, you know, just like the Normans, just like this, just like that. But of course, we're Christians, so obviously we consider it a happy ending that we kicked them out, and yeah. because otherwise I would be speaking Arabic to you right now. but the reality is that no one really saw it, in at least as I was growing up, as anything but history. In fact, I don't think we have any. I've got friends who are from Tunisia and grew up together, never was a problem. I think it's the current political situation with the way some, not that I want to go into immigration politics and stuff like that, but are changing now because of the current political scenario. But in general, all of these invasions are just looked at as, well, it's just a Tuesday.
Okay. You know, all right, I suppose so. Yeah. I mean, is there any one yeah. of them, I guess you've sort of already answered it with that answer, but are there any ones that are like you're particularly happy or proud of? Like, are you proud to have been such a core part of the Roman world? Or,
oh, yeah.
or like you're
yeah.
particularly proud of, like, I don't know, Roger II or something?
I think at least that could be me, but I was brought up, like my mum, when I was 8, she was reading me the Iliad, the Odyssey, the Aeneid and all that stuff. So I am proud of the Sicilian component, of the Greek component in Sicilian.
The Greek component, right, okay.
And so that is the one thing that I would say I'm mostly proud, that and Rome, probably. The two things the most, also because, again, depends where you go. There is this incredible villa called Villa Romana del Casale in Sicily, where it's like Roman, and all the frescoes, you see all the, oftentimes if you Google Roman gladiators, you're seeing frescoes from this villa, or mosaic from this villa in Sicily, because it was the villa of the posh Romans that would go and relocate to spend a holiday in Sicily because of the beautiful Mediterranean weather. Nothing has changed. So you still see the villa and all the frescoes, and that's where you see, have you ever seen those images that look like there are women using dumbbells wearing bikini?
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever seen them.
Yeah.
That's where it's from. That's the villa. That's the place.
All right. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they look like that's a place, and it's in Sicily, and it's a gorgeous, very well preserved villa where you can see all the different sections where people would go and do the sauna, then cool down, then exercise, and that kind of stuff. But then, if you move a little bit further east, then Naxos, built by the ancient Greeks, with all of the ancient structures still there. So, literally, depending on turn left or turn right, Greek or Roman. Huh. That's how it's going to end up.
A great way of putting it. Now, there's so much, and I'm conscious of time, and there's loads of things I'd want to talk to you about the 20th century.
Oh, yeah.
I know it's a bit of a jump, perhaps, from the crown of Aragon and someone like Peter III straight to sort of the 20th century, but talk to me a little bit about Mussolini. What do you and what do Sicilians feel about Italian fascism and Mussolini? Is he a complete embarrassment? Or not at all. I know lots of Italian people who aren't even particularly right wing, certainly not what you'd call fascist, but they're not embarrassed by Mussolini, far from it. They think he did very great things. What's your thoughts of his, and what's the average Sicilian's person's, do you think, feeling about that?
Yeah, so Benito Mussolini, it is, in my opinion, a dark chapter in Italian history, as it is for any 20th century totalitarian regime, whether it be the Austrian painter fan club in Germany. I don't want to get you demonetized, so I'm not saying the word, or whether it be the USSR with Stalin. I mean, they're all, the totalitarian regimes remove freedom, and so when you remove freedom, it's a catastrophe. But with Giovanni Gentile, so the writer of the theory of fascism, and Benito Mussolini, The one thing they did right was architecture. So if you go to the central post office in my city in Palermo, it's a fascist building and it's gorgeous. Like the huge columns, the imposing, almost square like structures.
It looks deco, amazing. Art deco stuff.
Yeah, I think that's the term. I'm not sure. But they, so the structure is great. I guess they made advancements in sports. But in general, he was a warmonger. And in, generally speaking, again, I don't know how many people consider fascism a good thing in Sicily or in Italy in general. Most people see it as a dark chapter in our history. Also, because, I mean, at the end of the day, we did lose, didn't we? And interestingly enough, the Sicilians specifically, when the Americans, the Allied forces, entered through Sicily, Sicilians didn't fight. They didn't want to have anything to do. They accepted it. It's like, yeah, come in.
That was the next thing. Before we get onto the actual invasion in 43 or liberation of it, one thing I want to say just before we move on from Mussolini is something I've heard some Italian people say, and I've even heard it written about, I've read it about. One of the things he did do was fight against the mafia. Is that really true? Is there a lot of myth going on there? What's your thoughts and feelings on that? Did he really do much there? And if so, was it good? Was it ultimately good? You tell me.
I think it was a PR campaign, because the idea is the mafia is a reality even today. It's real. If you open any business in Sicily, you have to give a percentage to them or they'll burn it to the ground. So it's just how it is. And the reality is that he did say that he was going to do that. And he did, as far as I understand, again, I'm not a specialist of modern history, so you might need to double check. But as far as I know, he definitely tried. The problem with the mafia is that it's not easy to stomp out. I mean, even when I was a child, I remember I was 10 in elementary school, and they suspended the class because there was a judge called Falcone. He was an anti-mafia judge, and mafia exploded him. They blew up, they basically placed TNT and explosives underneath the bridge and the asphalt, so that when the cars would go through, would explode. And I remember that because we wore the shirts, because the mafia killed two judges, Falcone and Borsellino. And Borsellino was exploded. They made his car explode in front of his mother's house when he turned on the ignition. And as 10-year-olds, I remember wearing the anti-mafia shirts at school because they had taken out the anti-mafia judges. That's insane. The anti-mafia judges should be the most well-guarded of all the judges, because they are the ones that try to prosecute the bosses.
No, I know the story all about Falcone, absolutely.
Yeah.
One thing I'll say before we get on, again, before we just get on to 1943, there's the book, Mario Puzo's the Godfather,
yes,
the original
yes.
book. Then the yes. second book, his second book is just called The Sicilian. And uh-huh. in that, that's not the events that you see in the film Godfather Part 2. The filmmakers that made The Godfather decided to just not really do that book. Because
okay.
that book,
okay.
Michael Corleone is in it a little bit as a bit part. But it's all about Sicily and people, the Sicilian people, militias fighting in the hills and fighting mm-hmm. the local mafia. And the Corleone family, Michael Corleone, is very, very tiny, mentioned a few times in it. The whole book yeah. is about, it's set on Sicily, about the culture and about,
yeah.
It's very, very deep. I don't know if you've ever read it, but I read it
no.
about 2 years ago, roughly, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. I'm sure you would like it. In fact, I'd love for you to read it and tell me what was nonsense in it and what rings true for you. But if you haven't read it, let's
sure
not talk about
it. I'm sure he did his research.
So in 19... Sorry, go ahead.
Just one thing I want to tell you. Of course, Corleone, famous. Have you ever heard of the mafia boss Totò Riina, the Riina family?
Is he the one that was only caught a few years ago and he was very, very,
yes.
very old? He was like in his 90s,
yes.
but they finally caught him a few years ago.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. I'm
yeah, that
about
one.
That, yeah. yeah,
I remember that his name... I remember my mum... She wouldn't even say it out loud inside our house. So, like, literally, there's no one. And my mom would say, "Tamam." She would whisper it. And I said, "Who? Totò Riina?" She's like, "Shh." This is what I'm talking about. Like, in our house. Like, no one on the third floor, second floor of an apartment building, because Sicily has a lot of tall apartment buildings, unless you go to the rural areas. And she was, this is how frightened people were of the Riina family. She wouldn't even say, like, Voldemort. Basically,
yeah, right, yeah, he who cannot be named. Fascinating.
Yeah,
fascinating. So in 1943, the Allies, yeah. the United States, Great Britain, as a fair amount of Canadians actually, after we've won the North African campaign against right. Rommel and the Italians in North Africa, that before there's the actual invasion of mainland Italy, there's the liberation of
yeah.
Sicily, and you've got Patton there, and you've got Montgomery,
yes, yes.
And so I suppose, well, again, you tell me, your grandparents lived through that, did they? And is
yes,
that
yes.
is that a thing you were told loads about when you were growing up? Is it something to be proud of? Is it something you guys are ashamed of? I really don't know. Well, how is it dealt with?
In general, Sicilians are like proud of the fact that we accepted the Allies, that we were fed up with the fascists. But one thing I'll tell you is this, because I do have a family history with that. So so half of my family is all Sicilian, and I was brought up and bred. Goodness gracious, what's the word? I can't remember the expression. Born and bred. There you go, in Sicily. But the other half is northern. My dad is from the northeast, and the Friuli region. And interestingly enough, his father was a colonel, I think, colonel major in the army, Alpine deployment unit for artillery, I think it was. And he refused to join the fascist party. So the fascists arrested him and they gave him to the Nazi officers who took him to Dachau concentration camp. So my grandfather ended up in Dachau and stayed there for a few years. So my grandmother, imagine, went through hell. And then the American soldiers liberated Dachau right before they were going to execute him. So he survived, and that's when he had my dad. So I kind of owe my existence to Allied forces. I have to say that. So having this kind of... So this grandfather of mine on the north, he eventually joined the partisans. And one thing about partisans is that they weren't all communist, by the way, because sometimes people think the partisans were socialist and communist, but by the end of the war, everyone was fed up with it, centrist, right-leaning people, right-wing, everybody, they didn't even care at that point. They just didn't want to deal with the fascists anymore. And he was one of those. He was no socialist, no communist, but he joined the partisans for the anti-fascist opposition, resistance. Whereas down south, my grandfather, down south, I'm not sure. I know he moved around a lot. At that time, I think he was in Sicily, but he was a banker.
So, and his wife, a pianist. It was kind of a special situation. I'm not sure if he had to deal too much with that, but in general, yeah, we Sicilians welcomed the Allied forces. Yeah. We're like, yeah, please, well, please come in.
One of the things that is sort of usually gets talked about, if you watch a documentary or read a book about the Sicilian campaign in 43, is that they like to point out that a lot of American intelligence, military intelligence, was bound up with, again, American US Sicilian mafia, where they had family, deep connections still to Sicily, and they and there was all sorts of intelligence and espionage and counter espionage going on behalf of the Allies and the Americans behind enemy lines, essentially, and that really, really helped defeat the fascists. Again, from what you know, is that more myth than reality, or did that really sort of, was that a really big element of it?
Yeah, I mean, I think at that point you'd have to ask a specialist. It wouldn't surprise me, though. And the reason why it wouldn't surprise me is because I think mafia is an awful thing. And the stuff they do, like if you tell on them, they'll melt you in acid. That's one thing they used to do even up to the 90s. Or like they will wall you alive inside a building and let you there to die as you're walled behind bricks, stuff like that. So mafia is awful. But mafia, does, in its awful aspects, it also brings in order in a way that unfortunately has some positive ramifications. And let me tell you one, if even today, but this happened 10 years ago, it doesn't matter. If you walk around Milan, there will be like foreigners or like, we call them extracomunitari, but like, I don't know, people who are like, come there and just wanna grape women, mess with women, whether it be, I don't know where they're from, but you know what I'm talking about, whatever ethnic group it is, they start causing trouble and they're foreigners, and it happens in Milan. It happens a lot. Women are afraid of going out at night. Never in Sicily. You don't touch a Sicilian woman. Why? Because the mafia is going to melt you in acid. So like, it's an awful thing, but in this case, at least they're doing what the government is supposed to do, which is protect the local population. So this is one positive aspect. I've never heard of a foreigner causing trouble in Sicily when it comes to like, oh, they're messing with their women. Never heard it in my life.
Interesting. I'm not saying very interesting. I didn't want to spend a massive amount of digging, like really, really digging into the mafia with you, because one, it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? Two,
it is,
there's so many more interesting things to say about Sicily. I mean, if you're ever good enough to give me a bit more of your time one day, I'd love to take any one of those things we've talked about today and just do an hour and a half just on that.
Sounds good.
But okay, I mean, I'm going to have to draw it to a close there. I would just say, once again, without being too sycophantic about it, thank you very much for your time. I really, really appreciate
it. Thank you, Bo.
And if you ever want to come on again, just say the word. Anything you want to talk about at all, I would be more than happy to sit here and chat to you. So if you can let people know where they can see, if anyone doesn't know who you are, I can't believe that's the case, but let them know where they can get you.
Absolutely, but thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. It's fantastic time.
Thank you. All right. Well, there you go. That's Metatron, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you've enjoyed that. And well, until next time then, take care.
Take care.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com, and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.